Hey, Dan, Terminator is back.
Uh-oh. What do you mean?
Well, AI is just getting smarter and smarter and smarter.
Yeah. Our podcast today with Evangelos was really cool. He talked about that, right? About the beginnings of AI in the 80s and how it's developed over the last four decades.
Right. And he really talked about how the processing power has increased over the last 10 years. And that's been the leap forward in making AI relevant for the rest of the industries.
Yeah. One thing I thought was really cool is he's been involved since the beginning. And he was telling us what people thought was the scope and the capabilities of AI is nothing like what people think about it today. It's really developed by leaps and bounds. And now it's pervasive in just about every industry, right? From automotive to biotech, any field that uses data, right?
Yeah. And I think the one thing he really understands is how to help automotive industries or any industry bring data and AI and all this new technology or industry 4.0 into its core business. And I think that's the guy you got to talk to if you want to make your business really succeed using data.
Yeah, so, great. Absolutely.
Well, welcome to Mobility Now. I'm your host, Amit Mehta, head of innovation at North American Lighting, where we look at what are the technologies sitting at the edge of today, but will be at the center of tomorrow?
And I'm Dan Davies, Innovation Manager at North American Lighting. North American Lighting is a fully owned subsidiary of Koito Group, the world's leading manufacturer of automotive headlights.
How are you, Dan? It's been a while since we've been in the same office.
It certainly has been. Yeah, I had to actually look for some lunch places today. Didn't know where to go. Ended up going with some fast food.
Fast food. What's your favorite?
I don't really have a favorite, but I guess I go to Burger King a lot because that's close to my house. They've got a good Whopper. Yeah. How about you? I know it must be hard for you. There's not a lot of vegetarian options at fast food restaurants.
Yeah, there's really not. So for me, it's Taco Bell. I mean, I like Taco Bell.
Taco Bell.
I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's very easy for me to get some vegetarian options.
That makes sense. Did you know there's a new Taco Bell in Paris right next to the plant? It's brand new.
Oh, wow. No, I had no idea. Yeah. That's amazing.
Well, I don't know if you heard, but Taco Bell was actually in the news. They are introducing a new subscription plan. So you have a monthly subscription to tacos. It's called the Taco Lover's Pass. It'd be perfect for you, Amit, if you like tacos.
Wow. I do.
Yeah. So, I was reading about it earlier today. You get a taco a day, I think, for $5 or $10. They're doing just this pilot program in Arizona.
That's it. Okay. That's insane. That's really cheap. I mean, I feel like no one will go to Taco Bell for just the taco. You're going to want other things and you're going to snowball into, okay, I want nachos and a drink and fries and everything that come with it. And I mean, that's great for Taco Bell as well, right?
You don't go in there for just one taco, right? Absolutely. Right. I think there's a lot of benefits for Taco Bell too. I really think it's a brilliant idea because now, first of all, you have a revenue stream that's not dependent on on-site visits. Right? So you're not dependent on the customer actually going to your store. But there's a lot of advertising engagement opportunities for you because now you've got the contact information of your customer. Mm-hmm. You can incentivize them to go to certain stores by offering them an exclusive deal at that location or a particular product. You know, maybe you've got too much inventory on your bean burrito, so now you offer some incentives for bean burritos. You know, it really gives them a new way to engage with a customer and make sales.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, if you think about it, they're grabbing a lot of data about customer preferences, right? So what time of day they eat, how much salsa or sour cream or meat they want on their tacos. And that really helps with their supply chain. And what I read recently was just by offering this digital subscription, their revenue has jumped by 35% for people who have joined the app. And that's insane. They were customers that were already part of their ecosystem. Just by introducing this digital application, they've made 35% more than they would have from that same customer. Incredible.
Absolutely. I think it really changes the perception of value for the customer. Mm-hmm. It's a new approach to your product offering, even though it's the same product.
Right.
By offering it in a different way, it changes the way the customer perceives it and the way they utilize the service, right?
Totally. And if a company like Taco Bell can do it, can change something from a commodity where you eat the product and you're done to something where, okay, now it's digitized. I can control my supply chain based on my customers' preferences, gather data about them. Then a lot of corporations can do that. And this is a great segue into introducing today's guest, who has founded 3 companies, has been investing in startups for the last 20 years, and continues to help corporations navigate into a digital world. I'd like to introduce Evangelos Simotis. How are you today, Evangelos?
Well, very nice, and very nice to be here with you. Thank you for the invitation to participate in your increasingly popular podcast. I read the Taco Bell story, and it's actually particularly relevant to some of the work that we've been doing both at Synapse and with a couple of our portfolio companies over the past year or so. What we are finding is that corporations from several industries are now interested in understanding the mobility profiles of their customers. So far, we've been talking about when we talk about gaining a 360-degree view of the customer, we were talking about understanding their purchase history and understanding their interaction history in the case of the web. Now, with the abundance of data that exists from connected vehicles, from IoT devices, from mobile phones, we are able to start understanding the actual physical mobility of the customer. And this is, again, the applications that, whether it is retailers, whether it is restaurants, are proliferating, give us the opportunity to get this very great insight. So in the case of Taco Bell, I'm sure they're interested in understanding how far is a customer willing to travel in order to go to a Taco Bell store to get their favorite food. Another important point that this announcement has made is that, and you made it, Amit, is that we're moving into an environment, we're moving into a situation where we don't always have to go to the goods, but the goods are starting to come to us with increasing frequency. This has been accelerated during the pandemic, but I believe it's a very important step that it's changing the way that people move, and it will have an impact on how businesses conduct their interactions with their customers.
That's a great entry point into this podcast and in moving into the first question. But thank you for summarizing everything. And I think it gives a good segue into what we're trying to talk about today. So the first question we'd like to ask you is, how did you get to where you are today?
Well, so I came to the U.S. from Greece over 40 years ago now to study, started under a scholarship. I went to Caltech for my undergraduate. And what was interesting about that experience is that it gave me a first taste of interdisciplinary work, what we're now calling systems work. If there is one kind of lesson that I have carried through my careers, you know, over the next 40 years, has been that it is important to look at problems with an interdisciplinary, with a systems angle, as opposed to trying to always specialize. I came to Silicon Valley in 1990 did a couple of startups, as well as became an executive in a large company, in IBM. After selling my second startup, what I saw as kind of like a good progression of what I was learning and where I wanted to go, I joined initially a private equity firm, Apax Partners. Then through that experience, I realized that I wanted to be more in venture capital, so in earlier stage companies. So I moved to Trident Capital, and a little over five years ago with one of my partners from Trident, we started Synapse Partners. While this was all going on, I found the time rather to both teach a little bit as well as write a couple books.
That is really great. And I understand you've had some experience with the automotive industry too during your 30 years in Silicon Valley, which has really grown. I imagine in 1990, there were really no automotive companies here in Silicon Valley. And now we've seen it become one of the most densely populated automotive areas in the world. And so you must have really seen a lot. I'd like to hear your perspective on how the automotive industry has changed in the last 30 years and the time that you've been here, and where you see it going in the future.
Yeah. First of all, I would say that I got into the automotive industry and even wrote the books that I did, and I'm preparing now to write a third one because I saw it as an opportunity, a great opportunity, I should say, for applying data and AI. The big shift that is happening right now in the automotive industry is that we're moving from a largely mechanical, electromechanical system to a system that would be largely software. And in the same way that we, in the last, 25 or so years, we went from having the software-defined network and the software-defined data center and a bunch of other IT systems that increasingly became dominated by software IP. The same kind of revolution has started to happen in the automotive industry, where again, the vehicle now, the next generation vehicle, whether it is autonomous or automated, electric or fuel cell, hydrogen fuel cell powered, is going to be largely a software system. And it's going to be a software system that with a great infusion of AI and a system that is going to be emitting a lot of data. And this has come, very closely. I mean, I got into AI in 1982. I got into data shortly after that. I saw, in other words, the connection between the two. My PhD is in that area. So as this shift was happening in mobility in general, I became more and more interested and attracted to what I now call next generation mobility or new mobility, where data and AI will play a central role along with software itself.
I have to ask the question, what was AI in 1982?
That's a very good question. So, I have briefed boards of large corporations on AI, and the questions I get lead me to believe that these board members think that AI is 5 years old. And when I tell them that it is 70 years old, they, they light up. So in 1982, the AI was mostly about symbolic systems. We didn't have a lot of data at the time. I mean, I'll give you an example. My PhD dissertation was done on a database of, if I remember correctly, somewhere around 4,000 records, and was considered one of the largest databases at that time applied to academia. There were obviously larger databases, but at that time, so in the 80s, you have primarily what's called symbolic AI learning was, neural networks existed, but not to the extent that they are used today. My dissertation was around combining data-driven learning with symbolic learning and reasoning. But all of the components of AI that we talk about today, natural language processing, computer vision, reasoning, learning, obviously, existed at that time. It's just they were being done at a different scale or with a different set of systems. What I find fascinating, to be honest with you, is recently we spun out a company at Synapse, a company called Stipple, and that is dealing with the mobility, analyzing mobility. And we're using a combination of both symbolic systems and neural network systems. And I was talking to a couple of folks that I've known for a very long time, and they said, oh, you're working on a neurocognitive system. So it's coming back again as a kind of like state-of-the-art approach. But I would say now what has made it possible is obviously we have a lot more computing power. We have a lot more data. So we can talk about data-driven learning or statistical learning, as it is called, in a much better way, in a much broader application way than we ever could back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And frankly, I would say Google deserves a lot of credit for that, because they were probably the biggest proponent of bringing forward statistical AI and demonstrating its broad applicability.
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting. I think the public perception also of AI has changed so much since the 1980s, when if you said AI, you know, that would mean Terminator. I think that's the first thing that would come to a lot of people's minds, and maybe Hollywood influences a lot. But as AI turned into something that was sort of the science fiction technology into practical applications where we are using AI in Siri, it's starting to be used for autonomous vehicles, and a lot of companies are starting to implement practical applications. I think that sort of changed the public mind about what AI is and what it can do. And you mentioned that there's a lot of technological innovations that have driven it too. So I'm interested in knowing, how much does public perception drive the development of AI, and how much of it is just because the technology is there and it's this natural course for the technology to develop?
You know, it's a little bit hard for me to answer this question, because a lot of the work, I should say exclusively the work that we do within Synapse and the work that I've been doing all of these years has been around AI applications for the enterprise. So I can tell you though, back in the 80s, the primary application of AI was through the use of manually crafted rule-based systems. And there was certain brittleness that was associated with those systems. There was certain issues in how easily they can scale, because you need to have people who manually introduce knowledge. And one of the best advances that we have made applied both in consumer-oriented applications as well as enterprise applications is through the use of data and machine learning, you know, particularly through the use of neural network learning, that is now allowing us to build these highly intelligent systems that can be used most of the times in very narrow tasks, but doing better job than even humans in these very narrow tasks, and creating these systems automatically by using data and the right machine learning approach. We didn't have that to the extent that we have today. We didn't have that back in the 80s and early 90s. Very much like it happens now, public's perception was, you know, you had the dreamers that could think of an ever-expanding use and applications of AI in a variety of ways. And you have others who were more cautious and more, I won't call them afraid, but more skeptical about the broadening applicability of AI. Mm-hmm. So I think that battle is not new. Maybe the scope of it is new as the world has become more globalized, but it's certainly not new.
It shows that, you know, I mean, the way you've structured your company, Synapse, it makes me think that you understand what the automotive sector needs to move into mobility or digitization. So you have investment analysts, you have business analysts, and usually that's where a company ends. As far as Dan and I have seen, but you've also added data scientists. So why do you think this addition or this structure of your business helps automotive customers?
Well, so One of the biggest issues that automakers and I would say their entire supply chain, you know, tier one, tier two suppliers and beyond have had is the vehicle is shifting from being an electromechanical system to being a software-driven system with a lot of AI embedded in it. They realize that the people they have on staff and the approaches they have, the architectures they use, are completely inappropriate. So in other words, they need to transition from what they've been doing for the past, whatever, 60, 70 years to something completely new for them. So Synapse has been trying to both educate customers, understand how the strategic problems that they face can be addressed through the application of AI, where they need to collect data, what they need to do in order to become a data-driven company. Also tell them, by the way, which problems cannot be solved using AI, at least not for the time being. And in the process, because of our investments in startups and understanding very well the startup ecosystem for the startups that develop AI solutions, we can advise our customers, our corporate customers in particular, which can be the companies that can help them address these problems, even if they're not our portfolio companies, by the way. On the other side, by hearing about their problems, we felt, as we were starting Synapse, we felt that we will become better investors. And we spend a lot of time with our corporate partners, as we call them. We spend a lot of time with their chief strategy officer, with the chief digital officer, sometimes with specific business units, in order to understand what they term as strategic problems. And then we try to help them find ways to solve them. When we first started bringing data science into the firm, it was because we wanted to better analyze the data that we were capturing about startups. And we capture a lot of data about startups, not only the startups we invest in, obviously, but the whole space of AI software startups that we work in. And in order to be able to do a good job in that, we determined that we needed good data collection, good data engineering, and ultimately good data science. And this was an area, again, as even though VCs are becoming more data driven, and I've seen this in particularly in the last 10 years of working in the venture industry, they're not always, and I would say very few apply data science to the data they collect. So that was something new that we were bringing in. And later on, we also found out, because of the need that I mentioned earlier, that the same skill sets that we have and we use in-house can also be of use to some of our corporate partners. Mm-hmm. And we've been doing certain special projects with them. I think that makes us both better investors, better understand what our technology limitations on a first-hand basis. And I think that allows us to determine where to invest next and where not to invest.
Right. You're in a very unique position, aren't you? Because on the one hand, you see all these startups and the new technologies that they're rolling on, the solutions that they have for the industry. On the other hand, your customers are sharing with you their strategic problems, of which right now for automotive customers, there are many, right? We have a chip shortage that just won't end. The autonomous vehicle development is taking a lot longer than everybody expected. Electric vehicles, the development of these cost a lot. And it's really a hot topic for the news articles that Amit and I read. There's some articles that kind of point to this and say, well, these automotive companies are not at all prepared for the future, because they're still pouring all this money into development of AVs and electric vehicles, whereas Tesla and Rivian and all these new companies are sprouting up and eating their lunch, basically. Then there's the other kind of news articles that says, well, no, automotive companies are very much prepared for the future because they're partnering with these new companies, they're integrating new technologies, and they're embracing open innovation, which is something that we as North American Lighting hope to do as well. So you being a consultant, I'm interested in your opinion. Which story is right? Are automotive companies prepared for the future that faces them?
Well, the press tends to paint with a very broad brush on every topic, and this is no exception, the one that you mentioned. I would say it depends. We definitely see corporations that are realizing what needs to be done, and they're taking the right they're taking a set of steps that they consider right. There are others that are not doing that, and I think you find this in every industry. I mean, the challenge that so one of the ways that we help our corporate partners is in helping them take best advantage of the type of innovation that startups can provide for them. And this is an interesting problem because in the spectrum of innovation efforts, startups can only help you in certain ways, and mostly in addressing longer horizon innovations as opposed to what will be happening in the next 3 months or 6 months. And the large corporations have a problem in that, particularly in the automotive industry, because they need to maintain their existing business model, continue to perform, continue to, you know, quarter after quarter, go out and talk to their shareholders about the fact that they have achieved certain performance that they had promised to achieve. And in the meantime, they need to be making a very fundamental change in the way, not only in the technologies that they are using, going back to what we were saying earlier about the software-defined vehicle, but also in the business models that that they will be utilizing. So you talked about Taco Bell instituting subscriptions. Well, automakers are also thinking about subscriptions. And automakers, for the first time, and this is something that I talk a lot about in my second book, are starting to think about, should I also offer mobility services to customers, to the consumer, or such as ride hailing, such as micro mobility, or should I continue just providing vehicles? And that's a big change that automakers and their board of directors and their investors have to come to grips with, because it is not easy. I mean, essentially, and I know it's a trite analogy, but you're really changing the plane while you're flying it. You know, for any industry, that's hard. And you need to have, in a sense, flawless execution. And the last thing, which, you know, you guys are very familiar with, these are expensive. I mean, these are very high investments that are necessary. I mean, building an auto factory, building a battery factory, these are not $100,000 investments, right? They require significant capital infusion for returns that take a while to be recognized and to be realized. So long way of saying, I mean, I empathize very much with the automotive industry, and again, the partnerships we form. We try to make their life as easy as possible as they make these decisions.
So it sounds like OEMs have a lot of tough decisions to make, right? And I really like your analogy that they're changing the plane while they're flying. They've got a lot of things that they need to keep doing because their shareholders expect that of them, at the same time that they have to fundamentally change their business. And one of those fundamental changes that I'm really interested is in the powertrains. Of course, we're making a big switch from the gas-powered engines to electric vehicles, and GM has been making some big announcements on the electric vehicles that they want to develop, Ford as well. So this is, again, hardware, though, isn't it? This doesn't really tie directly in with the service offerings or the subscription mobility as a subscription that OEMs would like to offer one day. So is this the right path, do you think, that OEMs are going down? And is this the right place to put their investments, since it is such a large investment, like you said?
Dan, that's a very good question. Because when people think about, let's say, battery electric vehicles, they only think about the battery, you know, the physical device, mm-hmm. and which has specific chemistry, which has specific connectivity. What they're not thinking about is a battery management system. And the battery management system is a software system. It's actually a very intelligent software system, because if you think about what does the consumer care about most when they are considering an electric vehicle, is what's the range? Am I going to be driving from San Francisco to San Jose, and all of a sudden in Sunnyvale, I'm going to run out of juice? Right. And by the way, this is not only a concern of the consumer, this is also a concern of the business. I mean, imagine that you are a packet distribution company, a logistics company, or a beverage distribution company, and you want to convert your trucks from internal combustion engine to electric. You want to make sure that on one charge, you can do a specific number of deliveries, mm-hmm. right? So what enables you to do that, obviously the battery is at the core, but the battery management system, which is, as I said, software, is a very important component of how this is accomplished. So the reason that you have now companies talking about, oh, we have longer and longer range with a certain amount of battery on the vehicle, is not only because they're increasing the density of the battery. They are also making that battery management system more and more intelligent, right? It understands how you're driving. It understands, I mean, eventually it should be able to understand where you're going and what are your needs for the day. Is this a commute day? I mean, if you were to take a consumer, is this a shopping day? Is this a vacation trip day? So all of those components come together to make decisions, which obviously the consumer doesn't see, but the consumer actually feels. And the same thing for the business, right? If you're a distribution business, a logistics business, you know, you're very interested to make sure that your vehicles operate under the conditions that you want. So where I think, again, from our vantage point at Synapse, where we have seen the industry being slower than we would have expected is in understanding the implications of data that's being generated. And when I say the implications is, you know, when you think of this path, vehicle to cloud, and everything in between, you know, how much will it cost you? How will you collect? What will you keep on the vehicle and what will you throw away? If you keep it in the vehicle, how long do you keep it in the vehicle? And when do you send it out of the vehicle? When you send it out of the vehicle, where do you send it? Do you send it to a partner's, to a tier one supplier's cloud? Do you send it to some other, to the OEM's cloud? I mean, there are many, many decisions that are involved in that pathway. How much is going to be your communication cost? Do you need 5G or is 4G? There are hundreds of decisions, literally. And then the final point, which comes, how do you monetize all this, is what applications do you offer? Right? I mean, for a couple of OEM partners that we have now, we're designing their application strategy. And we're designing, I mean, we're telling them what applications should reside, let's say, on the vehicle, which could include, I mean, you were mentioning actually extremely well this example that you had with Taco Bell, with being able to divert customers to specific shops by making offers, by having maybe special meals. All of that, by the way, our company Stipple does all that in terms of the intelligence that its engine incorporates. Mm-hmm. But all of that is based on the proper capture of data, having the proper capture of data, the proper exploitation of that data, and having the right applications, whether it is on the vehicle, like in that case, having it maybe as part of the infotainment system to give you certain messages, or being it on your mobile phone or in some other, or back in the cloud, in your data center. What are the applications that are going to take advantage of that data and that AI? So it's a very complex set of decisions, which again, automakers and their tier one and tier two partners have to deal with. And I thought that this would be happening a little sooner than it is happening today.
Wow, fascinating. You know, I really liked how you pointed out that battery management is really what the OEMs are providing in addition to the battery. And I thought that was a really good point when you mentioned it, but I also thought, well, that's actually happened with gas-powered engines as well, when they sold the engine as a hardware as part of the car. But also at the same time, gas mileage was a big customer demand, and OEMs were working to improve that to get more efficiency out of the same amount of gas. So OEMs have understood that they need to provide not only this hardware, but also the management aspect of the hardware to meet the consumer's needs. But what's changed, I think, is just the complexity of it. It used to be you build your engine, you put a price tag on it that covers your cost, including development and manufacturing, and that's what you sell it for. Now you've got all these partners that are working with data. You mentioned where to send the data, where to store the data. These are all new, and I imagine a lot of OEMs are going to have different ideas about how they should make these decisions and what direction they should go in with partnerships on the partners that are providing those needed services. Do you see the OEMs that you're working with going in more or less the same kind of general direction in these decisions? Or is it really more of a spider web of all these different approaches?
So first of all, I will say that the thesis of my last book, which I published last year, is that the new mobility will require the collaboration of automakers, mobility services companies, and cities. But in order to be able to attain that state of collaboration, each of these constituencies will have to transform, to first transform, and the book presents certain transformations. But as a result of that collaboration, we will see new value chains emerging. And the point that you just made about whether it is going to be networks or other forms, maybe it's going to be linear chains, this goes back to this point that I was trying to make in the book, or I'm making the book, about the emergence of these new value chains. Now, different companies, starting with OEMs, will choose to participate in these value chains differently. So let's take GM. GM has Cruise. It provides autonomous vehicles. Through Cruise, they may decide to offer both a mobility service, so in other words, compete with an Uber, or just offer the vehicles to companies like Uber, right? Different structures. They are obviously developing electric battery electric vehicles, which allow them to have the more traditional relationship with the consumer or the fleet. They're getting now into they've created a new business to provide electric trucks to vans rather to fleets, and they want to manage fleets. So you see a company that not only is starting to be integrated more vertically, but also to embracing new mobility in more than one ways. On the other hand, you have companies like FCA that are sticking much more with their traditional OEM role. They will obviously, if they state that they will introduce electric vehicles, that's now becoming a must for every automaker. but they are not looking into other types of business as part of this new mobility and participating, in other words, in other parts of the value chain. So you have, you know, and there's everybody in between. You have the JV between Hyundai and Aptiv, you know, an OEM and a tier one in Motional, you know, Motional, which is going to be a provider of autonomous vehicles. So it's a fascinating ecosystem that is emerging. And that's, again, what has initially attracted me personally to the space, but continues to keep my juices flowing, as they say. And but also has provided a unique vantage point to the firm, to Synapse.
Great, fascinating. Well, thank you. I'll definitely have to read your book. It sounds like you have a lot of insights in there. Wow, well, this has really been great. I really learned a lot. Thanks for sharing your insights. I have one more question, and we always like to ask this question at the end. When speaking with somebody as successful as yourself, we think that people listening to this podcast will be inspired and want to join the automotive industry, want to get into venture capital and consulting. What advice would you have for somebody just starting out who aspires to follow in your footsteps?
So I always say to, whether it is my students or other folks that I'm advising, that I have found invaluable to have an operating experience. It doesn't have to be an operating experience in startups, even though I think you learn things by working in startups that you don't learn by working in a large corporation. And vice versa, by the way. But I advise people to not to come into the venture industry straight out of business school. They can do it, and obviously a lot of them have been doing it and have been extremely successful in doing it. But my advice is to always get that operating experience. Moreover, when you get that experience, try to come together with strong team. Sometimes I have seen particularly entrepreneurs or other younger people that want to be part of the startup ecosystem. They opt for the, let me call it, the chief's role, as opposed to working with kind of with the experience. And early on, I think the working with a strong team that has the right experience is a tremendous benefit. Similarly, I would say for people who enter the venture profession, working with firms, I mean, I consider myself extremely fortunate to be able to take my first venture steps under Apax. I don't think I would have been able to have the same kind of apprenticeship, because it is an apprenticeship, and venture capital remains an apprenticeship profession. I wouldn't have been able to have the same apprenticeship in a smaller firm, maybe that cannot accommodate that type of flexibility that a larger private equity firm accommodates. Right. But So to me, this idea of, again, working with strong teams, having the operating experience, having the apprenticeship with the right team, have always been guiding principles. As I said, that's not the only way to go. You can people have been extremely successful by following other paths, but for me, that worked.
Well, that's great advice. There's certainly no substitute for hands-on experience, is there? Well, Evangelos, this has really been a great podcast. I think we covered a lot of great topics, and I never thought we would have drawn a link between a fast food restaurant like Taco Bell and the automotive industry. But there's really a lot changing in both industries, and there's some overlap there. So that was interesting. Thanks very much for your time and for joining us today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoyed this episode of Mobility Now.
Don't forget to like, subscribe, follow, and share with your friends.